This podcast is brought to you by Scrum Gathering Canada. Learn more at scrumgathering.ca.
This is Jason Little, the world's greatest cold fusion developer, and you're listening to the Agile Uprising podcast.
Greetings and welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising podcast. I am this evening's host, Jay Hersko, and with me I have Andrew Leff. Say hello, Andrew.
Hello, Andrew.
I knew you were going to do that.
And Paul Elia. Say hello, Paul.
Hey, Paul Elia, no big deal. Hey, how you doing?
Well, that keeps with our trend of butchering everybody's last name.
Yeah, no, I've listened to the podcast before. It's cool to be a part of them.
Yeah, we have a running joke there that we can't ever get anybody's name right the first try. So tonight's topic is what we are calling usurping Agile, right? So this is a weird turn of phrase that most people probably haven't heard of. So I'm going to give a little bit of background, and then we're going to go into a discussion. So when we say usurping Agile, right, what does that mean? The best way to describe it, it's when an organization is going through an agile adoption, transformation, transmutation, and the leadership teams, so your middle management and above, they attempt to co-opt agile practices to fit what they're used to, which is traditionally waterfall. So they try and take some of the things we're used to doing as practitioners that lead to quote-unquote good agile and turn it into a waterfall-type reporting exercise to meet their pre-existing mindset, preconceived notions, to jibe with what they currently know because they may be afraid to step outside the box and learn something new. Sample examples of things like usurping Agile would be the attempt to turn the results of a retrospective into a RAID log, a traditional risks, actions, issues, and decisions log. Another example would be management trying to weaponize metrics, which I know we're going to get into shortly, a little bit more detail. Velocity per team member, what does that equate to? Forcing points equal man days. And even another example would be the whole conversation of when is code going to be in QA, right? So that is goes against every single grain of everything we know. So it should be a pretty interesting conversation because a bunch of us have had experience with this. So as far as experiencing this in their professional careers, Paul, you're the new guy, so I'm going to start with you. Have you experienced this sort of stuff or even heard stories in your coaching travels? And where have you seen an attempt of a leader or a leadership group trying to take this new thing and make it look like the old thing?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think this happens whenever something new comes along. You're trying to graft it onto your existing experience. So I don't think it's all evil. I think it's an attempt to map this new concept to your existing world. You know, this is one of the pros and the cons of having picked the word agile for what we do. Who doesn't want to be agile, right? So sure. From the innocent, like, hey, I thought we were supposed to be agile. Shouldn't we just be able to change what we're doing like every day? Right. And Mike Cohn says change isn't free. And he's got a nice little cute picture with the jar full of change. There's that. And then, yeah, of course, velocity becomes garbage as soon as you start comparing it across teams and looking at it in any way other than the team trying to get a handle on their ability to be predictable about what they're going to deliver.
So what are your thoughts, Andrew?
So, you know, I agree with what's been said. And if you guys are active listeners like Paul, you've probably heard me say this time and time again is, you know, defining what the agile journey is for the organization and what does that mean? So are we optimizing as a whole? Are we looking to, you know, improve? What's sort of our war cry for going agile? Because, you know, the one thing that Paul said that I'm not sure, I don't know if I disagree with it, but I don't know if I wholeheartedly agree is, you know, who doesn't want to be agile? I mean, as coaches, we deal with organizations that want to claim victory to say they're agile, but I don't know if they really want to be agile, right? So what are we willing to change to do something as opposed to just claiming victory that we're agile? So it's a compelling discussion, and, you know, we deal with, you know, I personally deal with it time and time again, and I'm happy because it keeps me employed.
Right. Well, now, when I said agile, I meant lowercase as well. Like, who doesn't want to be nimble? Who doesn't want to be, right? That kind of.
I can rattle off a bunch of clients that don't.
Yeah. Okay. I back off.
I have a good friend who I've worked with for on and off over a decade. He worked with me in my last job. He's at a place now where they're going through an adoption. They're going through a transformation, and they've sort of reached the point where they've got the mechanics down and things are running. I wouldn't say it's perfect. You're not starting to see those flashes of brilliance you see with potential high performing teams, but they're going through the motions and they're starting to get it. And now that they're slipping into a groove, right? This is where it's starting to become usurped. So this is the guy who had a long discussion with his boss about, well, what do you mean when you have retro minutes? What happens? How do you guarantee that they're addressed? And his answer was, well, the team goes through the whole list and they pick one thing that they want to concentrate on the next 2 weeks. And in the next retro, they bring that up, see if they've met it, and move on to the next thing. And it just conceptually, I mean, maybe it's a lack of training. Maybe it's a lack of exposure. But he legit told me it was a long conversation back and forth about why. It's not a raid log. It's the team being introspective and looking at things that they need to improve on, and then picking one and running with it. That was the first thing that he actually, the topic came from this good buddy of mine. He also pointed out that now that they're going through the motions, now people are starting to say, oh, let's do capacity planning so we can put it into a plan. And things are starting to look like a project plan.
Sure.
Go on.
No, so not to cut you off, but I will. I think sort of what you're illustrating are the daily challenges of you know, true adoption or true open mind to adoption. And are we building sort of a organization of trust, or are we creating documentation because we don't trust? So we need to enforce that you need to do these things so we can monitor and regulate and you know, create that or instill the command and control that we're pointing out isn't, you know, all these things that we're doing, you know, a raid log to, you know, metrics, whatever it might be to sort of showcase the anti-patterns that we have that we're not going to fix or not going to address because we don't trust.
Now, that's a powerful word and a good point. Paul, what have your experiences been in the regards to trust and that's role in an adoption? Have you seen it go well? Have you seen it go not well, go squirrely?
Well, I'm going to own up to being the bad guy in one instance of a past life. So I've looked at the data to try to understand on an individual basis, how many stories are they involved with? How many tasks did they create? How many stories that they play a testing role in, whatever. I mean, the data is there and it's juicy and I have access to it. And I want to see what's going on. Now, I will say, though, that I don't think I was particularly evil about it. I never used that data as a weapon. I used it probably when I would hear rumblings that, you know, I've usually more been in an executive role where I'm a layer or two removed. But I start hearing so-and-so's not really being a team player. All right, what does the data show? I want to go see. And I've had debates with people like I shouldn't have even been looking there. That was reading someone's diary. But yeah, I've been guilty of going to look for it and then going and having a conversation with the individual. Hey, I noticed these things. Tell me what's going on. I've also had that data lead me to the conclusion that somebody just didn't like doing the paperwork, but they were heavily involved, right? Just not using the tool in the way that maybe the Scrum Master would have liked for them to use the tool, but they were definitely a key player.
So do you think that knee-jerk reaction of, well, let me see the data, is that Is that our human programming? Is that programming that we've been through as in the world of Waterfall? That's, you know, since time immemorial. Because I will cop to the same thing. The first thing I always think of is, okay, well, let me see what the what does the iteration plan look like, and what does the burn down look like? Do you think we default to that because it's we think it's objective instead of subjective? What are your thoughts?
You asking me or Lef or
either one of you? Either one of you.
I'm admitting the sin here, you know. So.
All right, so then I'll pin it to Andrew. Andrew, what do you think? Why do you think we go right to numbers and go right to those metric-y type things?
Because that's what we know. It's tangible. That's what we've been conditioned to do over years and years and years of whether it be ill management or organizational sort of driver behind it, as far as we need to show that we're doing work as opposed to defining value and we're delivering value. So how do you measure value, and is points a good measurement of value?
Oh,
I don't know.
That's a great,
you know, I would say no,
I will agree.
but then again, how do you convince people that are conditioned to look for a metric that to move away from that and really do work based on a value proposition or a value stream? I'm not sure, you know, I shouldn't say I'm not sure. That's one of the areas that sort of is a bit of a gap in some of the transformation, or it's not focused on because it's big. It's really big. But it may not be big if you choose to focus on it. I think that's definitely, you know, it's one of the hardest things as a coach for me not to solve, right? Like not to point everything out that you're doing wrong and enable that learning for the team to go through it and try and insulate them to learn, or even the organization to learn, when they're being asked the metrics, as opposed to giving them the ability to say, why do we need to produce these? What's the value in it? What are you looking for? What problem are we trying to solve? As opposed to, are we just addressing that symptom of a systemic problem of the way that we work as an organization?
Yeah, no, I get the sentiment and I see both sides. I mean, you got to make pitches for money. Customers want to know by when will I have what. So there's some give that has to happen in this, and the trust is a two-way street. And as you're building that trust, how do you give those who give the money, the customers who give their trust in your organization to produce, how do you give them something to go on during the journey?
So it's interesting, right? So we talk about trust. Is trust given or is trust earned?
See, every management and leadership class I've always taken has always told me that trust is earned, right? But I do think it's in experiencing a transformation, I think it's a little bit of both. I think you need to create the environment. You know, I hate to use the term safe space, but you need to create the environment where someone can go out on a limb and introduce the idea of trust in a team or in an organization, knowing that if something gets screwed up, they don't lose that trust forever, right? Yeah. Because we all realize that, yes, mistakes will happen. I took a class, a leadership class from somewhere, and they talked about – they were using corporate examples of companies like the examples were Barclays getting caught rigging LIBOR or whoever was rigging – I think it was JP Morgan rigging the silver market. You know, that was years of corporate repertoire and reputation that they built up that was lost almost instantaneously because now nobody quote unquote trusts them.
So you said a couple interesting things there. If we screw up, do we lose that trust, or are we building organizations around safety, right? We should screw up. If we're not screwing up, we're not learning. So again, we're talking about a pattern that isn't supported in my experience with larger organizations, because failure is a bad thing. It's bad. We don't want to fail, right? No fail. All right, so we're going to learn faster. We won't call it faster, or we won't call it failure. We're just going to say we're learning faster.
No, and so I'm all about the safe environment. I'm definitely an advocate and a protector of that. And you hear cynical people laugh about the fail fast stuff and take jabs at it. But it is about learning. It's about being safe to make mistakes and learn. It's not about screwing up. I mean, you know, screwing up is a bigger deal to me. That's more unethical behavior that we were just describing, not, oops, I made a mistake.
True.
Got it.
True. And I would say that to me, I've all the teams I've coached, I define failure as failure is something not going to expectations and you not learning from it and doing it again. That's failure. Right? Mm-hmm. Everything is a learning experience. And if you make a quote unquote mistake, as long as you learn from it, it's not a mistake. It was actually a teacher. It's a learning moment. But when you keep doing that same thing over and over again, that's a systemic failure. Right. That's, you're not learning from your own, you know, missteps.
Right. And if there's malintent behind it, now I've got a problem with it. But if you're trying to do the right thing for the customer, if you're trying something that's a stretch for your ability, And you don't get it right, that's cool.
Right. And I think, but are we setting up organizations in their journey to support that, right? Is that the understood sort of meaning, and are people subscribing to that or invested in that, to invest in the people and not just sort of the outcomes? So how do we motivate people to want to work at trust? Because that's something you got to work at all the time. I mean, you use your personal life. It's not, once you break trust, it's, you have to really work hard to rebuild it and regain it. So I'm going to give you my trust. It's on you if you choose to break it. So it's literally, it's just given. It's, in my opinion.
Yeah. And that's how I'm wired as a person. I probably get hurt more than I'd like to because of that, but I would not have it any other way. If you're going to a personal life, but you know, there are people that are the opposite. You got to kind of earn their trust before they're going to give you anything.
Absolutely. Completely agree. And that's another whole, that's probably a whole other topic. You know, how do you earn trust of the people you're working with? So
guys, I need to have a drink. This is my first podcast with you guys. I can tell this gets deep. We're talking about Agile, right?
Yeah, we haven't made the hard left turn yet. Again, 20 minutes in, that's usually when the rails come off. So let me ask you guys this. So we're obviously experienced professionals, but say we're in the trenches and someone's going through the motions and they see that this is starting to happen, right? They see that someone is trying to shift these new concepts that they've been taught. They see this coming where it's starting to go, uh-oh, they're starting to want to weaponize these metrics, or they're starting to try and put things into the waterfall box, into the waterfall kit, even though it really doesn't fit. How do you prevent that? Like, how do you see that coming? If you see it coming, how do you get away from that? And what steps could you take as a, not even just as a coach, as a practitioner, as someone who's on a team in a trench somewhere? What are the things that you could do potentially? What are you guys' suggestions to help right the ship and get it back on the right path? And Paul, I'm going to start with you.
Well, it's interesting. Agile for me was something I didn't embrace right away. So I actually first got paid to write 30 years ago. That's for my age group. I was a young guy. My mother used to drive me to my clients. That's how young I was when I first started getting paid for writing software. I was reading the books that some of the guys that were at Snowbird were writing before they went into that famous meeting. And I was doing XP and Spiral kind of stuff leading into that meeting. And I was okay, right? I was happy with what I was producing. People were patting me on the back for my results. And so I didn't pay it much attention. And when it started getting more accolade, I think there was a collapse between Agile and Scrum. And honestly, there were some things about Scrum I didn't like. And so I fought it for a little while. this whole velocity business, I've never been right with it. So it's an interesting metric that people abuse, but I think it was there to be abused all along, in my personal opinion.
So velocity is always, I always love this discussion around velocity, and when I literally irritate stakeholders with this discussion, because I have maybe a bit of a radical stance. I don't know. It seems radical when I pitch it to non agile adopters, maybe, or people that think they've adopted. But in any case, Jason Cusack is a board member as well. I used to say this, and always resonated with me. Do you want a team that delivers more velocity or more points sprint over sprint? Is that a better situation as opposed to a team that delivers the same amount of points sprint over sprint?
Well, it doesn't matter. What's a point, right?
So are we in the business of delivering points, or are we in the business of delivering value?
Well, value, and that's hard to measure too, but value for sure. And go ahead.
So interesting you say that. So is it hard to deliver value and make, to be able to illustrate that?
I think it's hard to measure value in an objective way.
Or
every attempt that I've ever seen to try the games begin.
But is the organization even addressing that, right? So as an organization, are we looking to define how we measure value? So are we spending any energy in actually changing how we define value and how we measure that? So when we're doing work, when we're creating software, why are we doing this? So is it to delight our customers? Well, I don't know how you measure that. Well, how are we impacting our customers? Is it a reduction in call volume into a call center? Is it to improve an experience that we've received feedback that is not a good experience? Those are measurable things, right?
Sure.
So are we spending the time to actually do that as opposed to saying you need to deliver 40 points? Because I told my investors that 2018 we were going to have all this stuff done, but I never had figured out whether we could or we couldn't do it. It's just tied to my bonus.
Yeah. So every system is different, right? There are revenue things, there are non-revenue things, there's net promoter score type stuff, there's customer satisfaction type stuff. What system are you optimizing? What metrics do you care about? None of them are velocity, though. That's kind of my personal thing.
So, Jay, I know that you're the Uber PM on the call. So,
throw that in.
Oh, wow.
I say that in a good way, because you're one that, may think outside the box. And I think, to me, there's a lot of value in the waterfall universe, if you can use it in an agile mindset. But in any case, what's your third of thought?
So one of the things, I will tell you the whole idea of points, let's start with that. I forget who I saw the quote. Was it Ron Jeffries who said, I wish I never created them? Whoever created the idea of story points. Conceptually, when I have taught teams to that are transitioning to do points in regards to relative sizing, it makes sense. Okay, well, this is bigger than this, but it's not as big as that. Okay, it makes sense. The leadership teams have a lot of trouble grasping that, because two different teams could have two different sizes of points. So what I think is a 3-point story could actually be a 5-point story for Andrew, but it could only be a 1-point story for Paul, right? So that's the first thing I run into with points. Just getting people to conceptualize, don't pay attention to the number. The number, all it is a temperature gauge. And when you establish what your baseline temperature is, right? So 20 points every sprint for the first 3 sprints, that's 98.6. So are you running hot? Are you coming in above that? Or are you coming in less than that? Are you running cold? How to compare there? That's the first thing I run into with points. It's a very slippery slope.
So it's interesting you say, you know, we started talking about trust and then, you know, points. So to me, it's a way to create predictability, to build trust with the organization, that the team is predictable. I can predict.
That's what matters.
Yep.
I agree.
So that if you use points in that sort of conversation, saying the points are for the team to understand complexity and so forth, and really sort of build what we can do within a certain time box, but for the organization not to measure us on how many points we're delivering, but to allow us to be predictable in what we can deliver and what we can't deliver. And we use points as a team to keep ourselves honest, because points go away at a mature, when teams mature to a certain degree, they don't need points, right? They can just literally know what they can and can't do.
Right.
That's a great, I hate to say the word, but that's a great point. It really is. It's an awful pun, but I'm struggling for a word to replace right now. but you're absolutely right. It's one of the struggles as a guy who works with a lot of PMs who are in the middle of a transformation. And this is to a lot of them are PMPs. A lot of them are Six Sigma guys, you know, the whole SIPOC thing. This is one of those concepts that they really get hung up on. I think it's a good thing, but I think it's, if I have to give a word of caution to anybody who's getting ready to go through a transformation, is be a little patient with educating people, because this is one of those things where if you start to understand it, it gets beautiful. But otherwise you're they become weaponized and things go so quirky real quickly.
Well, something else besides the weaponization is, I think in the early adoption, and I've got my PMP due, by the way. I'm just recently announced the other day that I plan to let it expire with a lot of accolades and pats on the back. So that felt good.
You're voted off the island.
Hey, I held on to it and renewed it for a while because it was expensive and hard to get. I felt like it seemed like I was one of the ones that got audited. So I felt like I fought for it. I should hold on to it. But in any case, I think one of the things that I see in early adoption is this notion that, you know, the business delivers this business requirement specification and they fought really, really hard to get the funding to do it. So I'm going to throw a bunch of stuff into the stew here. It's like the project funding model, right? Scarce resources, fought for the money, got the money. Thank goodness. Had to wait a while to get it, but now I've got it. And by goodness, I want this entire specification done. So it's the concept of a experiment on what the customer might want, or what the business person, product owner, call them what you will, might do. That's not there. It's all or nothing. I want the whole thing. And when can you deliver it? Right? And so that... they'll go along with the story, especially, and listen, I've done velocity. I've taught what you guys are saying, and I get it. But they go to, fine, whatever. What's your velocity? You got your stable velocity. Okay, cool. And they want to slice up that requirements spec and know when the whole shooting match is going to get delivered. And that's not the mentality we want, right? We want to have test and learn. Delivering useful stuff as continuously as you can. Like, that was the breakthrough that got me to come and say, what, you know, look, I need to see what's going on here in this agile universe. My spiral is incremental, not iterative. And I think the big breakthrough for me was realizing, see, when I embraced spiral, I was trying to minimize the amount of code I might have to throw away because I didn't quite get what was being asked for. So I wanted to do stuff and show stuff more frequently so that I wouldn't have to throw code away. But the breakthrough for me was I realized the business doesn't always know what the heck they're doing either.
Yeah, we're all in the same
boat. Right? And it's like, hey, they're not this, you know, omniscient. If we could just do what they say and understand what they got in their head, that we'll all be great and well off. They don't know either. And that's the big breakthrough for me, is to realize, okay, how do we get these experiments? How do we test these hypotheses together in partnership?
So Andrew, before I go to you, plus one for Paul for using the word omniscient. I don't think we've used that yet in a podcast. it was almost as good as the, what was the word that Dean Leffingwell dropped, one that I actually had to look it up after the fact. I hadn't ever heard that word before. Andrew, what are your thoughts?
No, I agree with what Paul's saying. And I think, again, it's building the partnership as a team. So you don't have business and IT anymore, right? You're a team. Mm-hmm. So how do we work as a team to do valuable stuff? So how does the organization support that effort and sort of create that environment? You know, culture is the last thing to change all the time. So it's a lot of things that, you know, to sort of focus on, but how do we start to build that partnership that creates that trust that supports that sort of mindset? Is, you know, there's lots of different ways to do that. It's just each organization has to learn that and providing guidance around some of the principles and practices that, you know, these are some areas that you could focus on to help build that, to create sort of those short-term wins, my favorite thing in the world. That all lends itself. And I think everyone's looking for the silver bullet that we're now claiming we're going agile. So that's going to fix everything that we've been struggling with for the past X amount of years. No. It's going to amplify everything. And it's going to give you the opportunity to start addressing those things and create sort of that plan, if we want to call it that, on what we're going to start working on. And then we're going to inspect and adapt, right? And see what's working and what's not.
I forgot who said it. Somebody said, Agile doesn't fix your problems. It just amplifies them and brings them to the forefront. And that's no truer words have been said, right? All it does is throw it under the microscope. Was that you? Was that you, Lev? I gotta write that one down. So before we go on to the next topic, I want to give a nod to Paul. We definitely need to do a note to self, and now that I'm gonna put it into the recording so we don't forget, we need to do an episode of the role of a project manager in Agile and Agile PMs, the PMBOK, that sort of stuff. I do think there's a knee-jerk reaction from a lot of Agile practitioners, especially the dogmatists, to use a beaten analogy, throw the baby out with the bathwater, but I do think there's a decent amount of good knowledge in that PMBOK that does fit into the iterative Agile world. It's just not even shoehorning. It just, there's some good knowledge in there that I think most people knee-jerkingly will throw out.
No doubt. And so it's just, it doesn't serve me anymore with who I am. And actually, I'm done with Agile. I'm gonna be real bold here. And I say that tongue in cheek. I like the little A, not the big A. I'm done with all the marketing hype. And that's why I love you guys at the Agile Uprising. I'm glad to be a part of it now because it's dogma free. It's not Agile with a R and a circle around it, right? I'm over that. And I'm also into the DevOps universe. So I think about where Agile coaches tend to go to work. I know that we all want to focus on the entire system, but there's the business to the technical glue that I think Agile coaches focus on a lot, and we need that. And on the DevOps side, it's getting the dev and the infrastructure and the ops guys to play nice together and the security guys to play nice together. And I'm in a big environment now. I'm not trying to plug it. I work for SunTrust. Huge regulatory issues. Lots of cross-team dependencies. And oh my goodness, we need program managers and project managers to keep all those dependencies straight. So absolutely.
Yeah. And, you know, someone when I was, gosh, I can't think of the name right now. In any case, you know, project manager, I think it's also setting up people to be, you know, welcomed. And we talked about this early on in one of our earlier podcasts around, whether we've been inflicted or invited, right? So yeah. It's project managers doesn't automatically make you a product owner or a scrum master, right? So it's setting you up to to be part of the process and part of the transformation. And you may retrospect on your role and how it may or may not fit and what you can do to sort of evolve. That seems a bit utopian in thought, but it's just, I'm not sure how many places are actually looking at doing that, right? It's like, oh, you're a project manager. There's no PM role in Scrum or, you know, it doesn't call it out.
It's a conversation that happens in whispers, right? But I've seen it for middle managers too. One of the topics that's near and dear to my heart is middle managers in the Agile universe. We absolutely need leaders who are looking out for people and their career development and their training and excellence in a particular niche of the universe. So it's completely wrongheaded just because Scrum didn't define the roles.
Right. And I mean, we could go in another left field and talk.
Yeah, sorry,
about
how, I don't even know what field I'm driving around in.
don't apologize, but I mean, my point is, if you want to talk about roles, I mean, which is probably another podcast topic, is roles in the Agile world. I've had people come up to me with the safe big picture and say, "Where do I fit in this?" And because I couldn't answer in a knee-jerk snap of the fingers response, they got nervous.
Absolutely.
So that's a whole other topic for a whole other time. So let's close this one out. Yeah. So say you Andrew, you Paul, myself, we walk into an environment and we see that Agile has basically had the waterfall markers put around it, right? So we've created PM-centric metrics to look at project management type, old way of delivery. We have raid logs for the retros. We have all sorts of planning activities that go on that really resemble what amounts to a giant delivery plan, integrated or whatnot. How do you dig yourself out of it, right? So if you walk in and you see they've totally weaponized metrics and turned it into a more PM delivery tracking tool, how do you fix that? How do you start unpacking that and remove the poison? And I think I started with Paul last. So Andrew, you get to go first.
So I'm going to give you the coaching response. As a coach, I'm not there to fix that. You know what I mean? I'm not there to tell you how to do it differently. I'd ask powerful questions. I'd want to know why is the team or why is the organization producing this information? Where are some of the anti-patterns that were, you know, why we've created this, and try and understand and provide some recommendation as to maybe we can deliver the same thing you're looking for, but just do it differently. So trying to understand the threshold of disruption at that point and really coaching an organization to try and think different, but not telling them how to do it, which is usually gets me fired. But
no, but it's the good coaching answer. I mean, I back you up on that, right?
Yeah, and I think it's an opportunity to sort of really put the investment back in the organization that they have to decide this stuff. I'm not there forever, right? I'm not going to own this. They have to think at that level because they're going to own this. So preparing them to do that. But to answer your question, Jay, I think it's with that mindset, are there certain areas that you can challenge to do things differently? Yes. You know, does that mean we went agile? Does that mean we don't plan? No, it doesn't mean that at all. Does that mean we don't create documentation? No, it doesn't mean that at all. Does that mean we don't manage budgets and stuff? No. So it's just, how do we do that more effectively within the new environment that we're trying to create? Take Agile away. How are we looking to change the way we work today to do something different tomorrow?
Perfect. Paul?
No, I like that. Well, and there's conversation around leading indicators, trailing indicators. What are you really trying to measure? And again, I'm going to, you know, take my punches at velocity. I get that velocity can be used as a way to do predictability. I like it just fine when it's just a team conversation. It doesn't break containment, right? It doesn't get away from the team. as soon as it gets away from the team, I think it's garbage. So one of the things I like to do is fight metrics with metrics. Like, what do you really care about? You know, we had the call center example. Do you want to shorten the length of calls? You want to reduce the number of calls? That's good stuff. Let's talk about that. If that's your situation, you got to look at every system and look for those natural metrics that would make sense. Not this artificial construct called velocity. That's a team thing. Leave it to the team.
Andrew just brought up the remark of tough questions, right? Hard questions. And I think that's one of those things where people, we talked about respect earlier, right? And trust. If you ask those questions and people start to understand why you do, you end up with a level of understanding that you didn't have before, right? So my big thing, I'm in the same boat. Why do you want me to create this plan? And usually someone knee-jerk response, depending on how combative they are that day, they'll get offended. But if you keep asking, you know, the forest or five whys, and you get down to the nuts and bolts of it, you start to realize that, okay, they're not looking for a project plan per se. They're looking to answer this question. And the only way they've ever answered that question in the past is with a project plan. So like you said, Andrew, what if I could show you a way to get that same answer in the new world without going through all those old steps? Would that be of interest to you? Those are the sort of tough questions and dialogues that it takes practice and it's hard to get good at. I'll cop to it. I still have trouble with it. But I do think those are the things that really bear a ton of fruit.
It's a great point. I mean, I think when we address powerful questions, it's all, to me, we should be able to challenge and ask and talk and discuss and always come from a good place. So if you come from a good place, the intent is genuine and it's to move in a positive direction. You may not like the questions that are being asked or might not agree, but that's open for discussion. So the response can't be, why are we creating this? Because I told you so. Okay. Well, now I really don't want to do that, right? I really don't want to do this now because my response to you is, I'm going to do this because I'm being told to do it. I find no value in it. And when I've asked you to help me walk through that, you weren't willing. So we've developed nothing but an adversarial relationship.
And it all goes downhill.
Well, you also, I'm going to also send a just devil's advocate. I mean, you guys, I've been listening to the podcast for a while. You're in the 50s on the episode count now. And I've heard the respectful taking the other side. And I'm kind of taking the other side just for fun. But I do think you have to have some finesse in your whys. Like, Jay, the way you said it didn't feel defensive. It didn't feel snotty in any way. It felt like a great conversation, like we're trying to get somewhere together. But I've had those same kind of whys said in a way that it was just super defensive or kind of snotty. And those whys don't generate the right dialogue either when they come off that way. Do you know what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely. It's not.
Why do you need to know this stuff? Well, damn it, I got customers that are giving me money they kind of want to know when that money's going to pay off. That's why I'm asking.
The better question is what question am I helping you solve by delivering this? Right, but you're right, a lot of it comes to communication and not playing salesman, but knowing how to ask the question in a way where you don't come across as condescending or combative. You're legitimately coming from a place of curiosity, trying to find where that kernel is.
And that feels like partnership. That feels like you do want to help me when I'm asking the question or asking for something. And you come back with a why in that tone. I feel like you're trying to help me versus why do you need to know that? None of your business kind of,
But it's also, so I completely agree with the tone, but, and the way you deliver and the way we communicate is, that could be a podcast in itself as well. But I think it's not everyone's ready to even have that conversation, no matter what the tone is. So, you know, meeting the person or the organization where they're at as well, and understanding, being empathetic to sort of the position they're in, and building that rapport can be important as well. So you may have to back off the whys. You know, you may not be able to go that route first. You may have to develop a different rapport with that person because they're not ready. Now, that's not always the right thing to do, but that might be what you have to do because if they're an influencer, negative or positive, you may need to play into that.
Right.
Awesome. Okay, gents, so we're just about at the top of the time, so I'm going to wrap it up. Paul, anything you want to throw out? Any plugs, speaking engagements coming up, blog posts or anything? How can people find you? Where do they know to look for you if they want to chat more about some of the things you brought up?
Sure. Well, I've got no books and nothing to sell. My name's pretty simple, Elia, E-L-I-A. LinkedIn is where I spend most of my time hanging out.
Okay. And Andrew?
So, nothing to plug, just again, continue to engage with us on what you want to talk about, what you want to hear. That's how we got to meet Paul. So here's a shining example of an experiment that went so far really well. So just continue to reach out and check us out on the Uprising, and you know, continue to give us the feedback. We want to know what's of value for people to listen to or engage with.
Yeah, I'm still getting my head around it, guys. It's a privilege to be here with you. I really thought you guys were doing great work, and I'm still getting my head around, oh, we're doing great work. I'm part of this now. How cool is that?
Yeah, we hope everyone feels awesome. A part of it. That's
absolutely. And that was actually part of the reach out, is how do we spread this dogma-free Agile across the globe? And I look forward to partnering with you on that. Awesome.
Great. Well, we love having
Thanks.
You. And again, Jay Herska, you can find me. I'm all over the coalition. Somebody made the remark, well, Jay, you sit at the desk all day, so you seem pretty active. that was a backhanded compliment / insult. You can find me on Twitter. I'm starting to get more active there. And it wouldn't be a podcast if I didn't throw out something completely not Agile related. So I will throw out This is Hardcore. The festival in Philadelphia 2017 was 2 weeks ago. I attended. It was great. And the videos are starting to show up on YouTube. So check that out. You might see some fat balding guy losing his mind in a mosh pit. So no hints to that. But once again, we do want to thank you, listeners. We want to thank everybody. I want to thank Paul and Andrew for coming on tonight. I want to thank all of our listeners. We've got a bunch of loyal cadre of people. If you like what you hear, please take it to the coalition and let us know. If you have suggestions for other topics or other things you want to hear talked about, please let us know. We're always open. If you like what you hear, again, we do ask that you give us a review on iTunes, because that does help. And we thank you all, and thank all our listeners for their time, and we'll speak to you in the next episode.
The place to be next spring is Canada. Our friends up north are throwing a party, a scrum gathering to be exact. Get yourselves to Toronto for March 26th and 27th and enjoy some fun with the exchange rate. Register, sponsor, or submit a session proposal at scrumgathering.ca. The gathering will be in the heart of downtown Toronto. The nearest airports are YTZ and YYZ. Also, a special discount is available to all listeners of our podcast. Use the discount code UPRISING, all lowercase, to get 15% off the regular price of the gathering.